Yeah, Lee, thank you very much. Lee was very modest. He sounded like he was working as a copy editor at the Herald Tribune. He was actually the publisher. And it's great to thank you for your hospitality here at GW. There are bio sheets here of the people on the panel. They're all very distinguished, and their biographies are far longer than this, of course. But we have a very wide range of people from different branches of the media here, print, new media, TV. And they all have American experience, a lot of American experience, even if some of them don't have American accents. I myself covered a presidential election a while ago, and it was one of the most entertaining and stimulating events of my life. I want to get started, but I want to say first that this is being recorded for the CSIS website, so it will get to a whole lot more people than actually sitting in the room. I will start. We're going to make brief statements and then have Q&A and discussion. And I'd like to start with move from right to left, if that's appropriate these days, with Al May to start.
Thank you. Welcome. Reggie actually sent me some questions to address, and I thought it would just be easier for me to set those questions out there, and then the other panelists can respond to any of the particular questions as you like. With me, but differences will be worth it. First of all, my background is about 24 years as a newspaper reporter and editor, and I've been at GW for about 11 years teaching and writing about largely political journalism and the role of the press in our public affairs. So I speak from both a practitioner's point of view and I think somebody who has kind of observed it at least for a while. So Reggie sent me these questions. The first one was, how do American journalists and foreign correspondents overcome the challenges and avoid the pitfalls of covering presidential elections? He sounds like this is a really dangerous thing to do. Well, the great Scotty Reston said basically that what you need is a sense of history and a good pair of shoes. Now you probably need some equipment to go along with it. High tolerance of frustration and a deep skepticism of polls and television pundits, particularly those who used to work for politicians. You should know that they never really stop working for the politicians. Another question. Should they stick with the herd or go out on their own? The herd is a lot more fun, but it is also more expensive. Going out on your own is lonely and the work is harder. Probably more rewarding. I think it was interesting, the New York Times last month had a story about how the major newspapers have backed off staffing the presidential campaigns planes this year, largely because of the expense and the long campaign. My reaction was that was probably pretty good. I think if you want to simply chronicle what the candidates are saying in their travels, you can get a bank of television sets, and you can surf YouTube, and you're not going to miss any feeding frenzies on Obama's preacher or Bill's eruptions or McCain's temper, because everything now has become so immediate that you often wonder whether you actually have to go out and cover the campaign. So I think I'm being somewhat facetious. I do think that the herd phenomenon is still with us and has been for a long time, and maybe even worse because of the acceleration of the general climate of the media environment. Another question: how far should they go in focusing on issues, and how far on the contest itself? I think this is in our politics, a question that really is influenced by when you ask it. What stage of the election are you talking about? Our political parties are pretty homogeneous, and so our nominating process is less differentiated by policy. Issues do come in play. They help shape records, and they help shape ideological profiles of candidates in the nominating process, but I don't think that they really differentiate the candidates very much in the nominating process. And, for example, in the case of Romney, I think the there was a great deal of press scrutiny about his ideological and his record as the governor of Massachusetts. I think it was a perfectly appropriate example of how that plays. But the story of the primaries is one of a contest, and it has been, and it skews the coverage in that direction, and it's the dominant story. And I don't know any editor that would argue with this, given the wonderful story that we've had to see unfold, particularly between the Democratic candidates as we've gone along. So I don't see how the story shouldn't dominate. I do think you will see stark policy differences in the general election. That's when we tend to have that argument, and I think it will get covered. Should they try to predict results? If you can't signal to your readers or your viewers what is likely to happen next, what good are you? What is your utility as a journalist? I think the best advice is just avoid flat predictions, like McCain is dead and Hillary is inevitable. I always said, hedge your bets with the time-honored phrase. On the other hand, the conventional wisdom has had a rough time in this election cycle. It's probably been wrong more than usual, but it's been a very unpredictable election. I do think we have a higher tolerance for being wrong than we once did. I don't know if there's any true penalty being exacted for being wrong that I'm aware of. Maybe there should be. Are the problems different for print, broadcast, and electronic media? Yes, but not like they used to be. Not even like they used to be a couple of election cycles ago. The convergence of the media that a lot of us started talking about 10 years ago has certainly manifested itself this election. The web has changed everything, and something we've been all saying is happening, but it really, I think, has happened. The Pew Research poll has tracked this over the election cycles, and I think it's worth just a few numbers. The poll was released in January. About a quarter of Americans say they now regularly get their campaign information from the Internet. Now, that's double 2004, and it's almost triple 2000. That's a very short time in our election process. What's also interesting is Americans under the age of 30, roughly 4 in 10, regularly get their campaign information from the Internet. And about 4 in 10 also report that they have at least watched some kind of online campaign video. That's interesting because if you ask somebody over 30, you're only about 20% of them have ever gotten anything off a campaign video. So you can see what the demographics are going to do on this. But the old cycles of morning newspapers, the national evening news, even the publishing schedules of news magazines are largely irrelevant. Nobody waits. Everything goes to the web first. And it's reaching largely elite audiences, but at least it is out there. Our best example was the New York Times story on McCain and his relationship to the woman lobbyist. What was amazing about that story was that it was the Times published the story the day before they put it in the newspaper, broke it on their website. It had already been critiqued, criticized, massaged by noon the next day. The newspaper was still in the racks when the story had essentially almost, and it really didn't have much legs on it. But it literally been digested in that very short time. So the speed is truly astounding. Also, everyone now is using video. I think I actually saw this word in the New York Times, YouTubeification. This notion of this visual medium has really taken over, which is not why the Internet started out, actually. The Internet was started out as largely a print-oriented medium, and I think it's now moved very fast to a visual medium. And then finally, the last question was, how hard is it to be fair? I don't think it's any harder to be fair today than it's ever been. That's really not the issue. It's whether you are perceived to be fair, and that's extremely difficult in our polarized politics. And I would almost suggest to journalists that we should always remind ourselves that the viewers and the readers aren't fair in the way that they receive our messages. And I think that there's almost an over. I think there's a danger in being overly concerned about fairness, because I believe that it leads to timid coverage. One of the bright spots, I do believe, in the 2008 coverage has been a distinct uptick by news organizations in testing the truth of candidates. Not only have they employed the internet as a very useful platform for this, and I think one of the leading organizations by the Annenberg School is the factcheck.org, which has spawned a lot of imitation, not only in on the national level, the Post, the Times, National Journal, but also on the local level. And there's some evidence that local television stations and newspapers are using the web and have a greater emphasis on actually checking whether candidates are telling the truth. I mean, and I do think there's even in the old media a heightened awareness. The classic example would be Hillary and her Bosnian sniper thing. I mean, I think there is I don't want to overstate it because there's still a lot of election to go. But I do think the grades on the coverage so far are pretty mixed, with some bright spots.
Thank you very much, Al. Karen.
Sure. I actually started covering presidential politics. The first campaign I really covered in any sort of big way was the 1988 election, and it sometimes is very sobering to think it's been 20 years that I've been doing this. Of course, I was doing it for my junior high school newspaper. But back in those days, the first advice you would get as a new reporter on a campaign was, there are two things that you should never pass by because you don't know when you're going to see the next one. The first one was a restroom, and I can tell you that is still true. But the second one was a payphone, and it's so archaic to even think about how desperate we all used to be to find the payphones, because now, of course, everybody has that technology in their briefcase. But you do get this sort of look of desperation when you get to a campaign event and you see the traveling press corps arrive. The first thing that everybody is looking for is the power source to plug in the rechargers for everything. So some things do change. What is really remarkable, I think, about this presidential race is how treacherous it has been to hang on to anything that resembles the conventional wisdom. I think my first big story I did on this race was in the summer of 2006, and it was a story about Hillary Clinton and John McCain and how they were already emerging as the front runners of the two races. But what I wrote is that what everybody thought about John McCain, well, that everybody thought John McCain would be a strong general election candidate if only he could possibly get through a primary, but that was really going to be tough. And everybody thought that Hillary Clinton was an absolute lock to win the Democratic primary, and her problem would be in a general election. Well, of course, exactly the opposite has turned out to be true. John McCain, pretty much after some troubles last summer, skated through his primary, and now it's Hillary Clinton who is running behind. So that was my first indication that this was going to be a very different kind of election season, and that we really couldn't rely on any of the old patterns, any of the old assumptions to get us very far. And I think that when we see, especially on the Democratic side, the numbers of people who are showing up, the new ways of raising money that Obama is tapping into, you know, the new kinds of voters, young people, it really has, I think, been a great lesson for all of us that we really sometimes in this business should go ahead and let the voters talk and maybe actually listen to them for a change, which, of course, gets us to one of the questions that they wanted us to talk about, which is predicting results. I think with as many types of media that are out there, and I'm finding myself in all of them at once. I'm a Time magazine reporter, but some weeks it almost feels like the magazine is an afterthought, because by the time I get to writing my story for the weekly magazine, I probably will have blogged two or three items related to it. I will have written a piece for Time.com on the website. I may have talked about it on television. And so, you know, everything is moving so fast. But if I look at my main job, which is writing for Time magazine, the real value now is, in fact, sort of giving people as much as you can a guide to what lies ahead. And so my story in the magazine tomorrow, that hits the newsstands tomorrow, is, I believe the headline is something like, "Tell me how this ends." And, you know, what I do is, after a lot of reporting with a lot of people in the Obama campaign, a lot of people in the Clinton campaign, and a lot of Democrats outside of it, sort of tried to give readers a sense of what, you know, the three potential scenarios are that could actually end this campaign, and you know, what were the conditions for each of them. So it does always, we do find ourselves out on a bit of a ledge. But, again, I think that especially for those of us in the mainstream media who now find ourselves competing against so many other kinds of media with so many other different kinds of standards, that is really the test, is do we have the ability to help people navigate it? And if we don't, you know, we're all going to be out of business pretty soon. And so when we look at things like, are the problems different for print and broadcast, they're not, because we're now all doing basically the same thing. It's just the challenge, and hopefully this is different, but hopefully the standards are the same. And I must agree with Al, I don't think it's any harder to be fair than it ever was, but I do think that given the general volume, when you've got the blogosphere screaming in one ear and cable television screaming in the other and talk radio screaming, it is harder and harder to make yourself heard and also to convince your audience that you're being fair, because pretty much everybody, the most engaged listeners and readers are the people who are often people who are coming at us with a fixed viewpoint. So I think you need to, you know, acknowledge other viewpoints and respect other viewpoints, but you've also got to be willing to call these candidates, particularly when something they say is just absolutely dead wrong or absolutely unfair. So anyway, I will hand it over.
Jerry, I don't know if you're going to say this, but perhaps you could say something about whether the challenges of reporting for a foreign audience are different, and how far foreign correspondents here follow the American press, or whether it's possible to branch out on your own.
I will address that. I'll just a little bit about just myself. I've been in the States, in Washington, actually for almost 12 years now, and this is my fourth presidential election, previously with the Financial Times, and now with the Times. I'm glad to see Reggie gives it its proper designation, the Times. Unfortunately, in this country, it has to be called the Times of London. I've noticed quite a lot, apparently, to distinguish itself from another newspaper, which is commonly known as the Times of New York. I've been here for a while, and I have seen many of the changes that Al and Karen were talking about, and I really would echo their remarks, most of what they said. And I will answer Reggie's question specifically, but let me just say what I think perhaps the most significant difference, particularly about this campaign, or a process that has been going on for at least the last decade or so. I mean, it's clearly, and again, both Al and Karen touched on this, clearly the democratization of the news process. If you go back, people talked about the famous campaign, if you go back and read The Boys on the Bus, which I did, again, quite recently, one of the great greatest political books ever written, you can see there that 30, 40 years ago, you get a very good picture of how an election campaign, the news of an election campaign, was disseminated to the American people, or to the people around the world. It was disseminated through this sort of order of high priests of news, who were the absolute doyens of their profession, who followed the presidential candidates around, who were literally boys, because they nearly all were, I think, in those days, and they were literally on a bus. And they were, they determined essentially, they dictated what were the way in which the American people would read about, would cover the campaign, would understand, come to understand the campaign. Obviously, television had a more direct impact too, but that the role of those people who so led the campaign coverage, those senior journalists, many of whom, incidentally, interestingly, are still around today playing a similar role, is very, very striking and is very, very different from the way it's done now. And that New York Times article that Al mentioned touched on this most strikingly, perhaps, that many news organizations now don't even bother to have have reporters on the bus or on the plane, or they certainly not for the whole time. They will just switch in and out. And what's happened, I think, is you've just seen that there are so many more sources and availability of information for people. And let me just illustrate that by two stories, which give sort of anatomizing two stories for you, which have been very big stories in this campaign. The first is arguably the biggest, perhaps potentially most consequential story of the Democratic primary at all, which is the story of Barack Obama's now infamous remarks at a fundraiser in San Francisco a few weeks ago, which I'm sure you all know. He commented on how the immiserated working class of Pennsylvania, rural and small town Pennsylvania, clung, as he put it, in their bitterness to religion and guns. That's now become, you know, an absolutely one of the biggest stories. Now, that story didn't come out through the New York Times or through CNN or through any piece of reporting, actually, by any of the traditional media outlets. It came about because someone at what was supposed to be a private meeting recorded the remark. It was a private fundraiser, recorded the remarks, and in a very short space of time, thanks to the extraordinary speed with which electronic technology works, it was available on the internet, and it was everywhere very, very quickly. And that was, as I say, that arguably may turn out yet to be the most consequential story of the Democratic primary campaign so far. And that was, incidentally, a reminder that, you know, people, even when speaking at private, supposedly private meetings, politicians now increasingly need to be careful what they say. But it was an example of how the dissemination of news and information, and indeed opinion and interpretation of campaigns, has changed. And another example, and this is where I'll touch on Reggie's specific question about foreign newspapers. Another example was another very damaging story for the Obama campaign, which was, again, you'll recall, about a month or 6 weeks ago, when Barack Obama's one of his senior foreign policy aides gave an interview to, of all newspapers, The Scotsman, which is a Scottish newspaper, surprisingly enough, which long time ago would only have had a very small distribution, circulation. You could give an interview to The Scotsman, and I mean this with no offense to my good friends at The Scotsman, without any fear of anybody ever really outside Scotland ever seeing it. And obviously Samantha Power, the Barack Obama advisor who did this, was sort of still, for all her obvious talents, perhaps thinking that she was operating in that world that we used to live in. But she gave an interview to The Scotsman in which she famously said that, among other things, that Hillary Clinton was a monster. This was immediately put on The Scotsman's website, as you would expect. It was immediately picked up by those various aggregators of news, the Drudge Report and everybody else who trawls through these these various newspapers around the world, and it became again a huge story. Samantha Power within hours had to resign, and Barack Obama was disowning the remarks and some of the other things that she'd said. That, I think, is an example of how democratized, how widely disseminated the news process now is. That, again, as I said, if you gave an interview to The Scotsman 40 years ago, unless one of the boys on the bus had happened to pick it up and thought it was very interesting, it wouldn't have mattered in the slightest. Today, everybody has that information. It's around the world incredibly quickly. So just in that, that's an example, actually, of how things have got better for the foreign media covering these things, because actually there is no such thing anymore, if you like, as the foreign media. Because of thanks to the internet, everybody has access to everybody's news sources anywhere around the world. And we, therefore, it used to be, you know, foreign media on the campaign trail used to be regarded by candidates and their staffs as sort of like an anthropological curiosity, but not really, you know, didn't need to be taken all that seriously. I can well remember when I was bureau chief of the Financial Times here in Washington, we assigned someone, actually unusually for us, for pretty well the whole campaign, to then Governor George Bush's campaign. And I can remember Governor Bush, you remember, he had, then Governor Bush had a, and still does, had a tendency to give nicknames to people, and because he found it so amusing that the Financial Times had sought to cover him, he repeatedly referred to this reporter as Economics Man. And so there was this sort of sense of puzzlement and curiosity about some foreigner, especially a financial journalist, covering. Now, you know, that campaigns don't particularly, we certainly don't get as good access, of course, foreign media to the campaigns as the principal domestic media do, but they do understand that the foreign media can have an impact way beyond their circulation of their newspaper or television in Britain or Germany or France or China or anywhere else for that matter. So that has changed as well. We are all, you know, part of this sort of global news process. And I would say that that's that has also created pressure, I think, I hope, on foreign newspapers not to do what they've tended to do in the past, which is to follow, to answer Reggie's question, to rather follow the agenda of the American media. It has long been a cliche of journalism and foreign correspondents that, you know, they tended to be sent to a city somewhere around the world. What many of them from abroad would come to Washington because it's the most important city in the world for news, and they would tend to read the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time Magazine and various others that day or that week or whatever, and essentially recycle it for their readers. Well, again, you can't do that anymore. Your readers already can read the New York Times and Time and look at CNN. They don't. It's a pointless exercise to simply recycle what the American newspapers are doing, because everybody else can have it. So there is more. I'm sorry to say, unfortunately, that doesn't stop some foreign journalists from still pursuing this particular line of journalism. But I think that I think its days are numbered. Clearly, people are not going to want to do that. People are not going to want to read that kind of stuff for much longer. So that's putting pressure, I think, on foreign correspondents, again, to do a little more original reporting, to do more original journalism, and not to follow rather slavishly the lead of the major newspapers.
Thanks, Jerry. Ross, how does it look from where you sit or stand?
Well, I sit and stand in sort of an odd position, because I work for The Atlantic, which is in a certain way the oldest of the old media in the United States. We're the oldest continuously published magazine in the country. I think Harper's is technically the oldest, but, you know, they had a 70-year hiatus or something in the 19th century, so it doesn't really count. But so on the one hand, you have The Atlantic Magazine, where part of my day is spent editing pieces that are essentially, it's roughly the same approach to presidential coverage that we've been following probably for 100 years or more, which is to say, we're a monthly magazine. We're, you know, we fancy ourselves writing the first draft of history or something like that. So we're a few steps back, both from the daily newspapers and from the weekly magazines, certainly from television news and the internet. But then the other half of my day is spent as a blogger for theatlantic.com, which is, you know, the newest of new media. So in that capacity, I'm sort of deep in what Karen well knows to be the sort of swarming quality of internet media. I guess I thought I'd just offer a couple observations about that new media landscape, because I don't, obviously, for me, the change is, you know, a matter of comparing my own experience to what I've read about in books, because I wasn't really around and covering the elections of the 1980s and 70s and 1990s. But we're sort of in an odd position now, because on the one hand, people talk constantly and correctly about how this election is a revolutionary election. It's the first true internet election where, you know, the internet is, internet media and new media blogs, what have you, are really setting the agenda in a lot of ways for campaign coverage. And certainly, if you step outside the specifically media world, this is the election which the internet has completely revolutionized political fundraising and organizing, and Barack Obama is the main beneficiary of that. But on the other hand, I think it's clear that we're still on the cusp of a new landscape, and it's very tough to tell how it will all shake out, because, you know, it's true that the old media world, where you had a very small number of news organizations and sort of a cadre of almost priestly journalists setting the agenda for the country, that world has passed. But at the same time, it's still there. Because if you, you know, if you drill down into some of the statistics, I think Al cited about, you know, more Americans getting their news from the internet than ever before and so on. First of all, that's largely still only true among the younger generations. Second of all, even within the groups of people who are getting all of their news from the media, from the internet, most people are going to, you know, CNN.com, BBC.com, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so you have this sort of this strange situation where you have this incredibly diverse and complicated world of blogs and quasi-blogs and online publications and so on that are read by a fairly small number of people, setting the agenda for these old media organizations that are transitioning into a new media landscape that are read by millions of people, possibly billions, but probably not millions. And so it creates an odd dynamic where, you know, it's easy to forget when you're covering the election from the vantage point of the blogosphere that, you know, most people, most voters aren't reading 15 blogs a day. They aren't reading 5 blogs a day. They aren't reading 1 blog a day. They're still getting their news from CNN. And to the extent that, you know, the Huffington Post, for instance, really matters, it really matters because a blogger for the Huffington Post picks up Barack Obama's remarks in San Francisco, puts them on the Huffington Post, and then it gets picked up by the mainstream media. So there's that curious double effect, and I think one of the big questions going forward is as the generations turn over, which is a sort of kind way of saying as old people die off and young people get older, one question is, I think it's still very unclear whether the dynamic we have now will endure, whether there will continue to be these sort of large gatekeeper organizations and then this range of people feeding up through the gatekeepers, or whether more and more Americans, you know, whether you'll really have total diversification and, you know, you'll have millions of Americans getting their news from hundreds of different outlets. But within that landscape, I mean, I think the defining quality, as far as I can tell, of campaign coverage in this world is just the word more. It's name any quality, and the odds are you have more of it. So, people raise the question of fairness and partisanship, you know, and what's the state of campaign coverage? Well, the answer is that there's more partisanship in the media because there are more outlets and there are more outlets competing for audiences, and partisanship is an excellent way to find an audience. But then if you say, well, is there more or less substance being reported? And I think the answer is, again, there's more substance. There are more organizations not only that are out to fact-check the candidates, but there are more publications, especially online, that are devoted to constant analysis of policy in a way that television especially, but also newspapers and magazines simply have never had the space and the resources to devote to, you know, and policy analysis is also something that only works if you're willing to pitch yourself to a narrow audience. So it's something that's enabled by the internet, where you can thrive with a very narrow audience. So, you know, so there's more substance. Is there more frivolity? Is there more focus on petty, you know, unimportant scandals of the week and gaffes of the moment? Well, again, yes, because you have dozens and hundreds of people following the campaign's every word, following Barack Obama into private fundraisers and finding out what he says there. So the defining aspect is more. And I think the journalist's role in all of this, I've only really been a journalist professionally for 6 years, and really only for a few years. Since the first few years, I was a very junior researcher in the bowels of the Atlantic's vast machinery. And so I'm not sure I'm completely prepared to comment on what precisely the journalist's role is in filtering all of this all of this madness. I mean, I suppose I would make only one larger point, which is that what we are living through and have been living through for some time is the breakdown of a very powerful model of journalism. that dominated American life, and not only a model, but an ideal of journalism, an ideal of balanced, unbiased reporting that that was possible in a world where there were only a few major networks. There were big daily newspapers that had monopolies or quasi or duopolies in many cases, and that model is going away for reasons that primarily have to do with technological change, and we are moving back towards the model that prevailed in America for most of the, certainly the late 18th and 19th century, where, you have a plethora of competing and more partisan outlets, where more and more voice and partisanship is being injected into the reporting of the news. And I'm not sure that this is an entirely bad thing. I think the biggest challenge, though, for journalists is to remain, I would say, fair-minded in an age when they are expected to be opinionated, if that makes sense, which I hope it does. So that's my thought for the day.
Thank you. I just wanted to add a couple of thoughts there in light of what Ross said. I read somewhere that only 1.5% of Americans actually regularly read political blogs.
Which seems completely plausible based on my traffic statistics.
Yeah, also that conservatives read conservative blogs and liberals read liberal blogs. And the result of that is that the blogs often take a more extreme position, and so the people reading them think, oh, gosh, it's all right to move to the extreme because here it is on a blog. And so it actually can have a very polarizing effect. But perhaps Abby could have something to say about that.
I'm Abby Tatt, and I work for CNN, and I used to be called a blog reporter. I'm now called an internet reporter. I was a producer for CNN, and I started doing this job of covering the blogs with another woman right after the last election. The blogs had really started getting going the election before that, but, media takes a little while to... The old media takes a little while to catch up to the new media, and at the beginning of 2005, I was a blog reporter, and that's where a lot of the political discussion was going on online. It then, expanded into social networking sites, into YouTube. I now feel sometimes that I am the YouTube reporter because it is a visual medium, and that's one of the easiest ways to get through the senior producers is to have some kind of visual like that to get it on TV. Frank knows how that works. But the difference in early 2005 when I started doing this and now is really so marked. It's completely different. I think at the time when we started covering the blogs, the internet as a regular beat, we were treated as some kind of curiosity with a lot of skepticism. There was a lot of discussion, head scratching about why we were doing this. Now that question has just gone entirely. And what I'm covering, it's just as likely that any other political reporter for CNN is going to cover a story about the internet as I am at this point. A case in point this week was Hillary Clinton's big fundraising haul, which happened online after the Pennsylvania primary. Did I cover that story? No, because yes, while it has an internet implication, so many things do in this election that necessarily the political reporter covering Clinton was covering that story as well. So all kinds of people, because this election is so much to do with the internet for certain candidates, and there's so much discussion of it online, this idea that the blog segment is this curious thing that everyone kind of wrote about at first, scratching their heads and saying, what's happening? That's just kind of gone out of the window. In terms of, I kept coming back to this question about how hard is it to be fair? I do a very specific thing. I try and take stories that are happening on the web and then cover them on television. There are a lot of pitfalls there that have to do with production in a lot of cases. Another reason why people really scratched their heads at the beginning when we started doing the segments is we were showing tiny text screens on television, which looked absolutely horrible, and rightly people kind of wrote about that as well. There's been developments in technology, and certainly in CNN's coverage now, with magic walls that zoom in and out, and there are ways that we're covering it now that make it a lot easier. But in terms of who's reading the blogs, it's not everyone. And in terms of how the candidates are using the internet, they're all doing it differently. And sometimes I feel that I'm so concentrating on a particular candidate, it's you worry about the balance of it. Now, necessarily, that is part of the story. If one candidate, like Barack Obama and his supporters, are using the internet in such a way, then that is a story. But you can look at the way one candidate is, you know, blowing up online on YouTube, and another candidate, I remember a Rudy Giuliani blog post that had no comments at one point. You know, it's just different for the different candidates. And at one point last year, I felt like I was the Ron Paul reporter. I felt like the Ron Paul, whose candidacy is still going on, he's the Texas congressman who's still running for the Republican nomination, his supporters really, really pushed his candidacy online, and it's something I talked about a lot. I thought, I'm sure that any Ron Paul supporter would say that CNN did not cover their candidate a lot, but I felt at one point I was covering it all the time. So that's something that I always come back to, is how much I am talking about, say, Barack Obama, because his online numbers are so great, versus, say, Hillary Clinton, whose web operation is still extremely sound, but the supporters of Barack Obama and his web operation have really just kind of taken it to another level. Another thing that we have a lot of discussions about is what we are putting on the air. If something is big online, how big does it have to be to then go on CNN? It's something that I always think about in terms of my friends who are not going to CNN at 4 p.m. in the afternoon for their news and never would. They are going online to get it. So sometimes that's in my head. Well, putting it on CNN, does it really make a difference? But if there is something online that's got a couple of thousand views or 10,000 views or something like that, we're always having the discussion about, well, putting it on CNN, is it giving, especially if it's some kind of attack ad or something that hasn't been reported on before, are we giving it way more currency than anyone else's? And that really came home to me last week, the divide between how people are getting their news, which to me, kind of buried in this online world, always seems to me people are getting it in their inboxes, surely. Or that it, when I was talking to someone last week who had, there was a video online called Whitehead Women for Barack Obama, which was a group of women in Nashville, Tennessee, who had made this video with the help of a young man filmmaker, and in support of Barack Obama. The youngest amongst them was 79 years old. And I called the woman, I tracked down the woman in it after people really started watching it on YouTube, and said to her, you know, she was very confused when I called her. And I said to her, she's 83 years old, wonderful woman. And I said that, you know, people are really passing this around on blogs, it's on Daily Kos, and you know, there's just silence at the other end. And I said that, you know, there's 20,000 people have seen your video now on YouTube because someone's put it there. And she said, what's YouTube? I mean, that was the difference there. She had become kind of an internet sensation herself without really understanding how it had happened at all. So that things like that make me realize that these discussions should always be had about what we're putting out there. And then one thing that, just listening to everyone down the line here, this problem's different for print, broadcasting, electronic media. I think what everyone's been saying is the amount of platforms, the amount of deadlines, or the constant deadline. At CNN, it's like feeding the beast, you know. There's always, CNN is always on, CNN.com live now streams hours every single day. So I might do a segment for my show, which is on CNN Domestic. Then there's the CNN Ticker, which is a blog in its own right, which is constantly updating throughout the day. And then you might do a hit for CNN.com Live, which used to be called Pipeline. And there's just a constant demand for more and more segments, which is something I think is a challenge for everyone right now.
Thank you. Frank is the cleanup hitter for this part of the inning.
We're doomed. We're dead. We're gone. No, thank you very much. It's very interesting listening to this conversation. I think about, I don't consider myself a dinosaur, but I can lay claim to something, because I covered my first presidential in 1984. I was there when, you know,
so
Walter...
So it was your elementary school.
I was in elementary school. Walter Mondale declared, he won't tell you, I just did on the subject of raising taxes, and promptly went on to lose overwhelmingly. And when, you know, we were all wringing our hands and covering this incredible sensation, the first woman in history was on the ticket. So what was it like back then and up through the years when I was covering the Reagan White House and covering the Reagan re-election campaign in 84 and then beyond, when you'd get on an airplane and you'd hear a lot of noise and they were called typewriters, and when reporters got off the airplane and they went and had dinner because the office was essentially closed, and when they would hang out with one another and trade war stories and the echo chamber took place over a couple of beers or too many beers, and the gate role of the gatekeeper was sacred, impenetrable, mysterious. When guys like Lee Huebner, who was I'll give his secret away, was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon, among other things, and we still love him, and others would sit at the White House and say, we need to disseminate a story. Well, let's leak it to the New York Times or the Washington Post. That'll get us in the first news cycle. Then they'll ask us about it at the briefing. That'll get us in the next news cycle. We'll get 2-3 news cycles out of this. It's all gone. There are no typewriters anymore. There are no boys on the bus anymore. There is a bus, but I don't think anybody pays attention because mostly it's a virtual bus. There are no gatekeepers anymore. Not really. There are a few, and they certainly try, but it is ultimately and utterly changed. And I think I would say to you that I believe we're living in the best of times and the worst of times. I really worry about people going, manning the barricades and going to the blogs and the places that merely reinforce their own ideas. In a presidential election, you want to hear a lot of ideas, and you want ideas exposed broadly. But I also think that we have a phenomenal three-dimensional journalistic experience now that, if engaged properly, can change for the vastly better, I think, the way presidential races are covered. In those good old days, there was, you know, in the days of the gatekeepers, you want to talk about elitism in terms of who was deciding what the story was going to be. And often, as you pointed out, with foreign journalists, and not just foreign journalists, everybody, they went out to... What's the name of the place in Des Moines, the big steak place where we go?
Sabres? 801.
And I did it with Bob Novak and Jack German and all the famous guys. And you'd sit around and all the young reporters say, oh, they know what they're talking about. They kind of make notes. Then they go off and try to sound really smart, like, and older than they really were when they wrote their own stories. Because what was your experience? Well, now your experience, first of all, your news organizations have cut the funding. You're not out covering. And you have to listen to other people because they're emailing you and blogging you and yelling at you all the time. The way a story was orchestrated, choreographed by those trying to pitch the story to us has utterly changed. So Lee Huebner or whomever would leak a story to the New York Times, which would publish it anonymously the next morning, which would have all the journalists running after it throughout the day, who would then get it anonymously and proudly say, well, I have sources too, and publish it that night. And then somebody would say something publicly to get it in the next news cycle, and it would go on in that way, but in a very close-hold fashion. What happens now? Terry McAuliffe or Plouffe or Axelrod, they have listservs. They're taking emails in all day long, and they're blasting out. And you've seen guys on CNN reading off their BlackBerries while they're on the air, reporting in real time what they're being told or spun, depending on how you want to view it. But meanwhile, the vast public, as we mentioned, is watching and blogging and screaming and yelling and saying, that's not true, and they didn't say that. The campaigns have a great opportunity to both muddy the record and correct the record. Did John McCain really say he wants to be in Iraq for 100 years? Well, that's what the Democrats would have you believe if you listen to them. But you can go to his website and other websites instantaneously if you're a voter and see what he actually said. So this is what I mean, I think, by the best of times and the worst of times. I've covered 5 presidential campaigns. I've been on the floor of way too many conventions. And I think now that if I were assembling coverage, which I actually did do when I was bureau chief here, or at least helped to try to do that at CNN, thinking of multiple platforms, which we were then, but nothing like now, altogether different, I would still say to my team, what do we need to do to tell the story? How do we actually cover what's happening in the candidate? I'd break it down in clear editorial dimensions. What they say, what they do, where their money's coming from, what their policies are, their promises. I would fact-check it, factcheck.org, and a lot of news organizations are doing that. I would use, and it is happening broadly now, all these news organizations are using their websites in phenomenal ways to create this, what I call, three-dimensional journalism. You go on the New York Times. I did it yesterday morning because I was... Was it yesterday morning or this morning? I'm completely losing track, but I think it was yesterday morning. I was over at CNN, and I was doing something there, going on the air with something. And so I wanted to just refresh my memory as to who had won where. So both on CNN.com and on NewYorkTimes.com, up comes an interactive map. You can go and look and see who's won where, what the delegate count was from each place. You can go back and you can pull speeches instantaneously off the line. By three-dimensional, this is what I mean. I think the coverage of the campaigns and the coverage of a presidential campaign can converge as well. And a smart, good news organization will be able to use these different dimensions offered by these different platforms. The opportunity then is for on one platform, you're saying what's happening right now. You're telling what people are saying and doing and where they're going. Another place, you're showing where they've been. You're providing the history and the context and the background. You're able to demonstrate and have an archive, an ongoing archive. This didn't exist in 1984 or 1988. There was no way to connect your audience unless they went to the library with what had been said or done in a real-time way 2 weeks, 2 months ago. So an element, a layer, connects you back and allows you to answer your own questions. I think that by breaking down by topic and by area, you can examine in great detail and reality check in great detail to include cost and politics and all the other elements that go into any particular position, what those candidates are out there saying or promising or pledging. Can you be fair throughout this process? Yeah, but I'm not sure it matters in the same way, because among the many things that have been blown up is this notion of the gatekeeper, and that you're going to decide what's fair or we're going to somehow decide what's fair. We can be thorough, and there needs to be an element of fairness for sure and always in what we do, but it's harder. A couple of final points, and then we'll open it up because it's been a long time of us yapping here. Ironically, we had a reunion at School of Media and Public Affairs a week or two ago, 25th reunion of the political communication students. And one of our alums who had run for Congress said, you know, in all the media I use, I'll not forget this, Lee, ever, in all the media I use to get to people, he says, you know what makes the most lasting connection? Any guesses? Yard signs. The oldest, most analog media I can imagine, yard sign. For me, the most valuable reporting on the campaign, now obviously I'm, and all of us are slightly elite, but it will be music to Ross's ears, is The Atlantic. The length and the depth of... So I think two things are going to come back in vogue in a big way. I'm sorry, just with all this more that everybody's talked about. A place to go where gatekeepers still do exist to synthesize the news for me. I TiVo it and podcast it, but I actually like going to the nightly newscast because that, you know, the discipline of those guys having 3.5 minutes to tell the whole wide world forces them to be short, so I can get that fairly comprehensively and quickly. And then the longer, more contextual takeout. But people will be able to land on the dimensions, on the three dimensions of this kind of journalism that I mentioned, as they choose. And that changes the way we cover presidential campaigns. It utterly changes it because it opens it up to a much more contextual, interesting storytelling and historical kind of coverage than we've ever had before. It's the worst of times because a lot of people are losing their jobs. It's the best of time because a lot of people are getting jobs. It's the worst of times because people are manning the barricades ideologically. It's the best of times because more information is available to more people more quickly than ever before in human history. It's the worst of times because we've lost our gatekeepers. But it's the best of times because if people, and I think by this I mean voters and consumers, navigate this world properly, they can have a much better idea of what their candidates are saying and standing for, filtered and unfiltered, than ever.
Frank, thank you very much. Before we go to the floor, I just want to toss out a couple of questions and see if anyone wants to have a go at them, because I've just got back from a two-week speaking tour, 10 different stops in the real America, if there is such a thing. There was a famous BBC comic sketch once about two people setting out to find the real America and never actually finding it. But anyway, there were these people I was talking to, these real Americans, had two comments very in different places. They all said very much the same thing. The first one was that they see in electoral coverage a huge focus on the journalists trying to trip up the candidates and a concentration on petty disputes and not the real issues. And the other one was that the press is, or the media is somehow setting the agenda because they want a conflict, a contest to continue. And so as soon as Barack Obama looks like he's doing well, then all these things come up to bring him back so that the contest will go on, because that's what the media like. In light of what we've heard now, I'm not sure it's possible to set the agenda like that, but I wonder if anyone would like to have a go at those questions.
I have the mic. Yeah, I think that people, I think, have said that broadly and for a long time. I think it's getting louder. It's very interesting. How many debates, Karen? How many? 22 debates. I mean, you know.
On for the Democrats.
Right. And the idea that there are a bunch of reporters there, overpaid, over-pampered, living in a little bubble, constantly asking the same questions, sort of blew up in Charlie and George's faces in the last debate. So this, I think that one of the things that needs to change in the coverage of campaigns is who's doing the coverage. And I think there can be, will be, should be much more of a citizen voice. When you listen to citizens, they're absolutely convinced, and I think they're absolutely right, because what one of our biases is a bias toward conflict. That is partly what campaigns are all about, after all. And I think we're going to have more citizen muscle in this, and should.
Any other comments before I go to the floor?
What part of real America?
Well, you see, I was actually in the South.
Did you go to Georgia?
No, I was in South Carolina. That is real America? Oh, Georgia's real America. I have to go there next time.
By the way, I would just add that I don't think this is anything new, though, about a complaint about journalism, because if you look at what the most memorable moments were of the last umpteen presidential cycles, they tend to be gaffes. I mean, the Roger Mudd question to Teddy Kennedy when he said, "Why are you running for president?" and drew a blank.
That was a tough guy. He was really trying to trip him up there, wasn't he?
I know. It was not a, you know, it was... It was the now famous macaca moment on George Allen's part was certainly not a reporter asking about that.
What about Bernie Shaw's question to Dukakis?
That's right. It was there to be recorded. Well, the Bernie Shaw one, I thought, was a little. But anyway, so I don't think this is new. And I think that politics is, of its nature, conflict, because it's what contrast is about. It's a decision. It's a choice. It's two people who want the same thing, and only one of them is going to get it. So I don't know how you get around that.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think one of the interesting things is, you know, the strongest drumbeat of criticism, particularly of the Gibson-Stephanopoulos debate, but of the debate format in general, has come from the, you know, the partisan media on both sides. You know, if you wanted to see the fiercest critiques of the way the Republican debates were handled, go read National Review Online. And, you know, and after the Philadelphia debate with Obama and Clinton, you had, you know, a petition signed by a collection of journalists, but it was interesting to see, you know, it was all journalists from specifically progressive media organizations. And I mean, one of the interesting things, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with this in 2012 and 2016 and so on, you know, there clearly is an extent to which you do have a sort of people manning the barricades problem, you know, in where people are just, you know, just reading, as Reggie was saying, you know, their own right-wingers are reading right-wing blogs, left-wingers are reading left-wing blogs, and so on. But there is also a sense in which, you know, an injection of partisanship into the media process can actually improve the coverage of substantive issues. Because, you know, there is a, if you are a journalist for National Review, your investment in the Republican debates is somewhat different from the investment of a journalist from, you know, CNN or ABC or where have you. You are, by virtue of being a partisan, in a sense, more invested in the substance and less invested in sort of the showmanship, I guess, of debates. And so, you know, I mean, one of the things that has been running around the blogosphere is the idea, you know, that next time around there should be Democratic debates where the moderators are, you know, someone from The Nation and someone from The American Prospect and someone from other liberal magazines, and the same should go for conservative debates. And it would be interesting to see if you actually had more, you know, more substantive questioning in that sense. So, anyway.
Well, I would just say that whether it's old or new, if you travel around, anyway, that part of the real America I went to, that there's a huge, I'm afraid to say, distrust of the media. And there's a feeling that the media is setting the agenda and it's not the agenda that people want to listen to. And I recall some years ago now when Steve Forbes was running for president, Howard Kurtz wrote this piece in the Washington Post saying how the people following the Steve Forbes campaign were terribly frustrated because every time they asked him a question, he replied his three-word mantra, which was hope, opportunity, and something or other else, I can't remember. Prosperity.
Worked well for him.
Yeah. And why they were frustrated was because he did that, it didn't give them the chance to trip him up. Now, the implication of that was that the function of a journalist was regarded as being to trip up the...
I think people are... It's fine. They can get angry at us, and they should, and there's all kinds of places and blogs to let off steam. But people forget that the role of the media... The roles of the media are many. So part of what we are supposed to do is explain the issues, lay it out. Part of what we're supposed to do is be a vehicle, the mediated experience, we call it, for the candidates to connect with the public. But the other part of what we're supposed to do is to hold people to account. All right? And so if Hillary Clinton's getting up and delivering the same speech day after day after day, or Barack Obama, or they're not tough enough, or they're not, or they're contradicting something that they've said, or, Obama's voted present so that he never has to take a position and can run as an empty vessel, we'll get blamed. The media will get blamed, just like the media got blamed, rightly, around leading up to the Iraq War for not being tough enough. So people want to have it both ways.
Well, that hasn't.
Well, but there is does have to be. I mean, I agree, but there is also a distinction between, you know, I mean, there's a distinction between being tough on politicians in the run up to the Iraq War and being tough on politicians. And I would defend some of the questions that Gibson and Stephanopoulos asked in the Philadelphia debate. On the other hand, you can see why people are, you know, mildly annoyed by a presidential debate where the journalists are like, so who loves America more? What did they say? Does your minister love America as much as you do? Now, I think, like, the Jeremiah Wright controversy is a great example of actually how one of these sort of strange issues can lead. I mean, it produced Barack Obama's speech on race, which was a very unusual moment for a presidential candidate, where they were sort of forced or chose to take a controversy and respond to it with a very long and substantive response. Maybe it was inadequate in certain ways, but it was certainly interesting. But I think, the impatience of at least some media critics comes from, the seeming inability of at least some precincts of the media to make a distinction between tripping up the candidates on important issues and tripping them up on frivolous issues.
I would agree, and I would make the distinction between holding someone accountable and tripping them up. Those are different things.
Can I just one point too? Clearly, what's going on here, to some extent, the experience from Britain is instructive. Is that there has been, very interesting, Reggie, you talk about mistrust of the media. Clearly, what's been going on in the U.S. media now is an increasing partisanship in the media. And the mistrust originated, I think, and it's particularly interesting that you were in the South, and I'm sure you've got a particular view of the mistrust, if you like. The mistrust originated because many people in America felt that what is dubbed the mainstream media, as Patricia dubs the mainstream media, was dominated by by people who had a particular sort of homogenous liberal mindset. Rupert Murdoch always likes to say that, you know, he started Fox News because he thought there was a niche in the market, and the niche turned out to be 50% of the market. And I think that's, you know, that is what you're seeing, that actually, as people mistrust the media, because the media is trying perhaps to be objective, but is infuriating people of a particular position, those people will tend towards, as they do with blogs, they will tend to read, conservatives will read conservative blogs and liberals will read liberal blogs, and the interesting question is whether or not they trust those media anymore, or whether we have a more reliable media because we have a more partisan media. I mean, in Britain, so we have very, very partisan press, and you know, interestingly, a television company, the BBC, which is notionally at least objective. Notionally objective. A lot of us don't believe it is at all. But that's and has that led to a diminution in the quality of journalism in Britain? I don't know. Yeah, that's a subject for debate. But it does seem to me the question, this mistrust of the media that originated, as I say, I think, and again, quite legitimately, with a lot of people's concerns about what they saw as liberal bias in the media, is creating a politically disaggregated media now, where people are getting their own media because it broadly concurs with their own view of the world.
Do we have any questions?
I employ others to do it. That's probably the answer. It's a good question because and it touches on something Ross said, which is that you do have still this. Although we all acknowledge that the days of the sort of sacerdotal community of people interpreting the events of the day and going over the entrails and determining what the story of the day was, that's gone. Ross is absolutely right in that the stories come from a multiplicity of sources now, but it still matters what those. The editors of those major news organizations, be it CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post, or actually, interestingly, the Drudge Report, the editors of those news sources, how they decide what matters. So we do still have this odd duality, if you like, between a much broader range of instant, direct news gathering, if you like, and still the editing decisions that are being made by newspapers. So for a foreign journalist, you are still... You are still dominated by, as everybody is actually, but dominated by what the New York Times still decides to put on its front page, or increasingly, I have to say, to my great grief, what the Drudge Report decides to report, because I can absolutely assure you, everybody in London, you know, looks at the Drudge Report every day and decides that because the Drudge Report is saying that somebody, you know, somebody's had a two-headed baby in, Indiana or something, then we should go and do something about it. So, you know, but whatever, regardless of your news priorities, those aggregators of news are still very important and are still forcing you to do that. The other side of it is, and this is where I just don't know the answer, is how many people in Britain who really want, if they want news about the US election, can get it, and I'll be the first to admit this, much better information, much more comprehensive, much better reported, much more, just much more reliable information from the New York Times' website or from CNN's coverage, you know, than they can ever get from the Times of London. You know, say simply just by the nature of our own resources, we can't possibly match that. So what I don't know over time is whether people who want U.S. election news, or who, you know, in the same way, people in the U.S. who want to read about Britain, you know, why would they bother to read what the New York Times' correspondents in London write when they can actually read what the Times with its vast resources, or the Guardian, or whatever, is doing. So, and I don't think that's proper. I don't think that is in any way even close to resolving itself. You know, even close to being anybody figuring out how that is going to work. What is the role of in an age in which everybody can get any information from anywhere? What is the role of someone sent from one country to report supposedly to that back to that country on what's going on? And the answer is, at this point, we simply don't know.
Perhaps I could add a little bit to that as a predecessor of Jerry's, as the bureau chief of the Financial Times here. When I was doing that job, when the early morning call came through from London to discuss what was going to be written that day, I was the person on the spot, and I basically decided what was going to be written. Now, with the internet, the editors in London, or indeed in Paris, Stockholm, Rome, or Warsaw, have all read the New York Times and the Washington Post and, on the internet before the correspondent has even woken up. So now when that call comes through, the editors are telling the correspondent what they want rather than the other way around. And there's been a huge power shift from the correspondent to the editor in Europe. And that may or may not be a good thing. I think it's sometimes very dangerous because the people who are editing in Europe often have a somewhat skewed idea of the United States, to put it a little bit of British understatement there. But anyway, let's hear from some more people at the back there.
Steadily waking up to this in Britain, at least, their prejudices about America are being somewhat corrected by this extraordinary Democratic primary campaign, where they're seeing, you know, tens of millions of people voting before, you know, before the general election. And much more importantly, exactly as you say, there is, just as a result of the primary process, there just is a range of sources of news, if you like, of competing interests trying to get their view across within one party, which you simply don't have. I mean, you know, absolutely right, in Britain you just have rigid top-down control of a party, and it's even more so on the continent, whereas here you have a genuinely diffuse, broadly disseminated seats of power within the Democratic Party and within the Republican Party, and it's a fascinating process to watch. And there is a sense that these, you know, you can't, I mean, it's a very striking that you can't even figure out really who is the leader of the Democrat? You know, there's been this whole debate here about who's going to step in and finally end this Democratic primary. You know, and the answer is nobody can, because nobody has that status. So nobody has that the analogous power that European parties have, where they can just say, wait, they can essentially just control what happens. And I do think, and I hope anyway, I absolutely agree with you, that people are perhaps starting to see the sophistication and the range that's out there in American politics is a little different from what they thought it was.
Yeah, that is absolutely true, I think. And there was a sort of rather sterile debate about whether anti-Americanism in Europe is anti-American or anti-George Bush, because actually the two are completely fused. And European media, very often people took George Bush as a sort of caricature of all they didn't like about America. So they were sort of the same thing. I don't want to get into a political debate. So I'm talking about the media coverage. Then just recently, you see the European media waking up rather late, actually, to the idea, gosh, there might be a woman president of the United States. There might even be an African-American. I mean, our old paper, the Financial Times, had a column saying that in about March, I think. You know, everyone thought it was a little bit behind the curve there, but it was with astonishment. And
they can tell you what it would mean for commodity prices.
Well, this particular columnist is not too hot on commodity prices. But it was a sort of, gosh, can this be America? You know, this is actually happening. And it's very interesting that one of the cliches in Europe about the United States is that it's racist. And the people who in the media who've portrayed that cliche have managed to disregard the fact that the last two secretaries of state have been African American, that they've ignore the fact that the Supreme Court justice is African American, but if it is actually a president or somebody who's close to presidency to be as an African American, I think it will have to lead to some sort of an agonizing reappraisal, which may be very hard for these people who like to believe that America's racist, and they'll have to go through a great deal of contortions to get there. But one of the very encouraging signs was Jerry will appreciate this, is the Guardian in London, which is hardly a pro-American newspaper, and is guilty of a lot of the caricatures, in my view, actually said the other day, watching the Democratic primary, we might have something to learn from America. Now, that's pretty astonishing. I'm sure you'll agree with that. Anyone else? Yes, Andrew.
GW a few years ago on the rise of the internet and politics, we actually traced it back to the Hotline, which is now a national journal, went up on a CompuServe bulletin board in September of 87, I think, and that's really, we marked that as the beginning of the internet, and it has been heavily used as kind of an elite medium aimed at elites, and I think that's continuing, and I think the Huffington Post is one example, but we've also had a new entry in Politico, which is a web-centric, it still publishes a newspaper, it's a web-centric vehicle that has a very definite elite-oriented coverage that talks even in the language of people that would know the language that they're talking, in shorthand and I do think that's a real mark of the new medium.
You just reminded me of a story I worked on last year of a website called Eventful, where people can go online and demand something comes to their town, a rock star or whatever it might be. And people were using it to demand presidential candidates, and a tiny town in Kentucky, population of just a few hundred people, in order to support rural America, lots of people in rural areas had demanded that John Edwards come out to this town. And I covered the story, and I thought it was a great website and people using the web to really, make something happen and bring democracy to where they are. And then when Eventful actually traveled there with John Edwards, who did go and do this event, there was no high-speed internet to upload the photos of the actual event, which really kind of brought it home to me that not everyone is getting this medium, not everyone is getting their information this way. But and that's something that I always think about. Am I placing too much attention on this area? Is it what comes so naturally to me? Is everyone else accessing it? But in terms of my show, in terms of a lot of people are covering internet stories, but I'm only doing it for a short, 45 seconds a day. So I don't think we're really overemphasizing it too much, but it's certainly something to always keep in mind, and that Eventful story really. And then also, like I mentioned earlier, talking to the older woman in Nashville who's just not getting her news this way, and also to certain people within CNN who, when I pitch a story about Facebook, say, what? And they just really can't get that people are using this. I think so there are checks and balances there. Not everyone, even internally at CNN, is on these same channels.
Can I just very briefly, I would distinguish between democratization of consumption of news and democratization of production, if you like. That is, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't know what polls still tell us, how many people get their news from the internet, 10%, less than that, something like that. But what matters more, and that obviously will change, presumably, over time. It's still a small minority. Still much smaller. But the difference is that what is getting through from what is going up from people, say the sort of production process, which is coming out in news in the traditional news outlets, which people are still relying on, is much more diffuse. Is much more democratized. That's the access that people have simply by having a cell phone or a camera or a laptop or a BlackBerry. To get their news, if you like, to get their interpretation of the news out there is what distinguishes this era, I think, from say 20 years.
And if I may, I think what's really important to look at is not what are the absolute numbers now or what percentage of the total population, but compared to what? Compared to, as you pointed out, compared to a short time ago. So the Washington Post has 750,000-800,000 people who receive a hard copy subscription. They have roughly 10 times that number of people a month who visit their website. So say, Yes We Can, Barack's Yes We Can, the music video that was posted six weeks ago, the big Yes We Can thing, it got 7, 8, 10 million hits. That's a phenomenal thing. If only 1,000 people respond to something, that's a tiny number in an internet universe, but how many in a traditional newspaper days, how many letters to the editor got posted? 5. So while it's not complete and while it's still maybe confined to certain demos, it distributes differently. So you've got, and that's what's really interesting, and that's what I think is democratizing about this. So some people are merely going online to read the Washington Post, but they're reading a different product, and it's a more interactive product in and of itself. Others are going on YouTube and Facebook who wouldn't have been there at all before. What's the number of millions who've been online to visit or donate through Barack Obama's website? I mean, I think we have to look at this holistically, and I think it's nothing short of a revolution in the way we communicate and connect.
I mean, the other thing that might be said is I think the Ron Paul phenomenon is a good example of this, where you have the potential now for groups that are marginal within the sweep of the American population. You know, I mean, what percentage of the American public are Ron Paul-style libertarians? It's very small, and it's very difficult to sort of be organized and have your voice heard. But the power of the internet is also it's the multiplication of force that you get from small, scattered communities that essentially become larger and more influential just by virtue of being able to be in contact with each other. And that's not directly related to the production of news and journalism, but it is an important, I think, democratizing shift in the media landscape.
If I could just add, too, the sense of community it gives people, too. You look at when I was doing reporting on the early days of MoveOn, they said much of their energy came from, people who were like the only liberal sitting in his town in the middle of Utah suddenly finds out you are not alone. And, that also is the power. It's the connectivity. It's the, the sense that you aren't just one person.
I think I would just add we're still in transition towards people groping towards what all this is going to mean. But I think it's still the case that newspapers such as the Washington Post and the New York Times, however they acquire their news from whatever media, through the internet or however, still play a huge role in setting the political agenda, the sort of things that lead to political conflicts in Washington or people in Congress deciding to do something about it. Is very often, maybe this is just because politicians tend to be of an older generation than you, Ross, but they, if it appears on the front page of the Washington Post, it still has political impact. And there was another question, I think. Yes, right there.
Thank you.
that I think in our mainstream media we're domestic oriented because that's where the eyeballs pay. But it's largely an issue of finances and advertising. But I'm not sure I agree with that. That the internet, unless I misunderstood you, is that I do think it has opened up the world in a real marked way. So unless I'm misunderstanding the thrust of your question, I think we are less insular as a result of it than we were, I think.
One thing that's happened, too, is that there's probably less coverage of foreign affairs by U.S. newspapers, but it doesn't mean that there's less reading about foreign affairs by U.S. audiences. I mean, it's sort of the reverse of what Jerry was talking about with the foreign press in the United States. You know, if you're a mid-level daily newspaper in the U.S., you're probably cutting back on your foreign bureaus all across the board. But part of the reason that's happening is that, you know, the average American who wants to know what's going on in South Africa is going to read the South African press.
No.
I take a much more pessimistic view of things. I heard Ted. Not just there, but in his glory days at CNN, when he was saying we were going to open a bureau in every country in the world, and since those days, he got married not just to Jane Fonda, but to Time Warner. That worked well, but not content, he got married to AOL, which worked even better, which is why he lost seven of his $8 billion. And what's happened since then? And it has nothing to do with what happened with Ted and Time Warner and all that. But it does have everything to do with what's happened with the technology we're talking about here this evening and the fragmentation of the audience and what the business model is behind any of these publications or online operations. Because, you know, best of times, worst of times, best of times you don't have the monopoly anymore, worst of times you don't have the monopoly anymore. And so the ability for the Boston Globe to have their own reporters overseas gone. CBS, NBC shut down most all their bureaus overseas. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have, just as you said, you have much more opportunity because you can go to BBC.com or you can go to the Times of London, which I do. You can have all these things on your bookmark pages, your favorites, and pop through them in 20 minutes every day. But as American news organizations, U.S. news organizations, are doing less, and the Pew studies show this up. If you factor out Iraq, and even Iraq now isn't getting very much attention because producers are tired of it and it's all about ratings.
It's also really expensive.
And it's really expensive and dangerous and all of that. But it has the effect, I think, of being a great irony that you point out. At a time of incredible globalization of issues and communications, we're actually, arguably, doing less organizationally than we did before. It doesn't mean that there's less available to you. There's more available to you. But organizationally, I think we're doing less.
Yeah, and I'd pick up something that Abby said with regard to my real Americans I've just been spending 2 weeks with. They don't go to BBC news.bbc.co.uk. They are complaining that the foreign news, they do complain about the lack of foreign news, and they complain that it's not on their TV or in their local paper.
They lie.
They are lying to you
because if they were telling you the truth and they cared so much, that's where the eyeballs would be and we'd be doing more of it.
You mean from the ratings?
If the real people really cared,
yeah,
they'd watch these things. There's Frontline out there. There are shows that have tried this. But they don't get the numbers because they're more interested in, when you talk about international travel, in Paris and Brittany, and I'm not talking about places on the map.
No, it's one of the things people like moaning about, though, you know, whether they're right or wrong.
CNN for a while, and I'm not going to comment on this, I'll just throw it out there as a fact, but CNN for a while was simulcasting our CNN international show at noon every single day, so a domestic view, but they redid it, they brought it in earlier this year,
that's right,
the new one, yeah. So that happened maybe about a year ago. They decided after Frank EP'd and bureau chief the noon show years ago that was international, disappeared for a while, and then came back last year as the simulcast, so it's the only point you can really watch CNN International domestically. That show disappeared a few months ago to be replaced with a show, I believe, Ballot Bowl, which was to show the... which was basically the candidates speaking, just letting the candidates speak, no edited anything, just let them hear the stump speech. And now it's changed to a show that they're doing right now called Issue Number One, all about the economy. Now, my pay grade is just nowhere near making the decisions for why that happened, but I think that's an interesting evolution. They were trying to do an international show, but for reasons that I'll let you all, you know, guess. Right now, it's about Issue Number One to voters, which is the economy.
Let's have maybe the last question, I think. Oh, two more questions. Did you have one?
My worry is that the answer is that British journalists and editors are very good at distilling or reflecting back to the British public British people's prejudices about the United States, and that's what they want to read. They don't really want to know from our, you know, early point that the gentleman at the back made. They don't want to know actually how detailed and, you know, impressive and sophisticated the primary race is. They want to know basically that Americans are all stupid, religious nutcases and racist and carry guns and, you know, can go around shooting each other. And that's unfortunate. I'm really only just slightly exaggerating that. You know, the editing cast at major British newspapers, and I don't just mean, you know, the tabloids, I mean serious newspapers, and I also have to say at the BBC, the editing cast. That's what they think that British people want to read or see, and so that's what they give them. And you know, I mean, I'm not sure. Unfortunately, as I say, that may be the answer. I hope it isn't. I hope that the British people, you know, don't have those prejudices as ingrained as they appear to be. And I hope that over time, as they are exposed to more real news about America, as opposed to the sort of cartoon stuff they get in most of the British media, I hope that will change. But I fear. And this is the paradox of globalization here. That the more globally available information becomes, the more kind of narrow-minded people will be in their choice of how they pick at it.
You do have a sort of self-reinforcing effect there, which is that the editors think they want this view of America, so they give them that view of America, which confirms them in their view of America, so they want more of it. I mean, that's a danger. You find that a lot in Europe, in other, not just Britain. French TV is a bit of a specialist in this too.
And even in the US media, to be fair, I mean, it's better. But the US media, even, you know, the New York Times' coverage of Italy is somewhat cliche. You know, it's what my former editor of the Financial Times had a wonderful phrase for. It was called the swinging spotlight approach to news, which is that, you know, New York Times will run one piece about Italy every two or three weeks, and it'll always be about something, frankly, some sort of Italian cliche, you know, that they're all very well dressed, or they, you know, they all eat, and it'll be something, and it'll then be deconstructing this for you and telling you actually why this is and all that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, it's, again, it's a slightly elevated level compared with this ridiculous cartoon coverage you get elsewhere. But it's still the same. It's the same, unfortunately, here as it is elsewhere.
Well, could I add too that it happens within this country as well. At one point, I was in the New York bureau of the Los Angeles Times, which felt like being a foreign correspondent, and I recall that the quickest way to get a story from the New York Bureau on the front page of the Los Angeles Times was anything that I wrote that would have people in Los Angeles throwing their newspapers down and saying, why would anyone live there?
There's a phenomenon in it that you see in the German media. I'm just reading some research on this, where there's this one phrase, American conditions, which is used the whole time, and it's something really sinister, and it's always used in the context, we wouldn't want that here in Germany. And what it means is ruthless capitalism, robber barons, poor people dying in the streets, nobody caring about the less well-off.
This is a great country.
Exactly. These are American conditions. But the interesting thing is you never have a German journalist analyze it to see, is this really the commission condition? Are they really the conditions in America? Anyway, last question over here.
Glad to hear that. Some things don't change. It shouldn't.
Yeah.
I think that's very good and uplifting note, particularly with regard to European journalism, or issue might end. I would like to thank the panelists. I think it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion, which has all been duly recorded and will be available. Thank Lee Huebner and GW for having us here, and particularly thank Eve Copeland of CSIS, who's worked very hard on making this all happen. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.